so many countries which are misunderstood. India, Russia, so many places, because actually our point of view is simply not put up. I don't think the temple is a Hindu-Muslim issue. It's actually an Indian-foreigner issue. What is dharma? You carry everyone along and find the truth. This is probably one of the best times to ever be born as an Indian.
Hello and welcome. I'm Anupam Kher. In the ever-evolving landscape of 21st century, the focus now more than ever is on India, Bharat. Each week, I sit down with remarkable Indians to bring you their unique views on our great country, and this week is no exception. My guest this week is the fastest-selling author in India's publishing history, whose books have been translated into 20 Indian and international languages. He's a TV host, a producer, and a diplomat. Please welcome Amish Tripathi.
Namaste, Anupam ji.
Namaste. Bahut acha laga, but very wonderful to see you. One gets tempted to speak to you straight away in Hindi. Thank you so much. Though you are an author in English, took you so many years to write your first, to publish your first book.
Ji, I started writing my first book maybe around 2004-2005. Hmm. I wrote my first two books along with my job. I was a banker.
Hmm.
And had to keep at my job because I come from a humble background. So one has to be practical.
Where were you born?
Career choices. I was born in Mumbai.
Mm-hmm.
My father's family is from Varanasi, the holy city of Hindus.
Amazing.
And my mother's family is from Gwalior. Early years were in Odisha, western Odisha, close to Rourkela, the Naxal-infected area.
Right.
In those days. And then boarding school in Tamil Nadu.
Mm.
And then high school and college back in Mumbai. And then MBA from IIM Calcutta. So I've been all over. And I was a banker for 14 years.
Mm.
I wrote my first two books along with my job. The first book took me some 4-5 years to write. So it was ready by, I think, around 2008.
Mm.
Then we started sending it to publishers. Every single publisher who read the book hated it. They said, one of them actually told me, this is a guaranteed failure, book. The reason for that, some of them gave detailed feedback. They said, you've written books on a religious subject. I'm talking about 2008-2010, that period. And apparently the youth, which are the main market, apparently they aren't interested in religion. I was also told that your books are, it's a fast-paced story, but it's too long. It has too much philosophy. Someone, Anupamji, you'll not believe it. Someone actually told me, if you want to make a book a bestseller, you have to dumb it down. I kid you not. Publisher actually told me that, dumb it down a bit. You can't have so much philosophy and all. So everyone rejected. So for 2-3 years, no one was willing to publish it. So I self-published my first book. Lord Shiva's blessings, it just took off in the first week only.
And what prompted you to write a book?
I started writing the book for myself, actually. It began as a pure philosophy thesis.
What was the philosophy?
An answer to this question, what is evil?
What is evil?
What is evil?
So somebody told you that you speak well, you should write, or you thought of evil and...
My family and I, we were watching TV. And we discovered something very interesting. For the ancient Persians, the Zoroastrian Persians,
yes,
not the Muslim Persians, for them... Gods were called Ahuras and demons were called Daivas.
Okay.
Which is the exact opposite of the Indian pantheon.
Correct.
Because for us, gods are called Devas.
Devas.
And quote-unquote demons are called Asuras.
Asuras, yes.
In the ancient Avastan, Sir becomes Her. And it triggered a debate that if ancient Indians, ancient Persians had met, we maybe have been calling each other evil. Because my god is your demon, your god is my demon, you must be evil. So then who's right? Are the Indians right or are the Persians right? Obvious answer is neither. They're just two different points of view. True evil is beyond petty human rivalries.
Right.
So an answer occurred to me that what is this true evil? Some of those philosophies are drawn from the Upanishads, Isha Upanishad, Katha Upanishad that I read. Some my own thought. And I discussed it with my family. They said, Arey, it's very nice, write it down. Started writing it down as a pure philosophy thesis. And then got converted into an adventure. Idea being, write an adventure through which you can convey this philosophy.
Who did you give the first manuscript to read?
To my sister, to my brother, to my then wife.
And what did
they say? First three. They loved it.
They loved it.
I thought they are family. Obviously, they're going to love it.
No. I know your family. They will not love it just because they love it.
Then I thought, chalo, publish karte. Let's try it. And that's when it got rejected by everyone and I self-published.
And when you say I self-published it, it means what did you do?
Matlab, I actually myself invested in the marketing.
How many copies were first?
5,000 copies.
And how did you market it?
I made a trailer film for the book. At that time, no one used to make trailer films for books.
Right.
And I didn't have too much money. I was investing my own salary. So,
right.
Taufik Qureshi ji made the music for it.
Yes.
And we shot a model against a chroma screen.
Mm.
And then put in the Kailash Mansarovar out there. And very good music. And we launched it on YouTube and it just took off. No one used to do trailers for a book. We also made a sample of the first chapter with the same cover as the book.
Mm.
And I went to many of these chains, you know, Crossword, Landmark.
Mm.
And I'd gone in a suit. I was a banker.
Mm.
They weren't used to authors coming in a suit with a PowerPoint presentation saying, this is my marketing plan for my book. So I told them, ki, I have this idea. And this is the book. And I'm giving you a free sampler. What's your problem? Just display it at the store.
Mm.
Okay. So we started distributing this first chapter as a sampler 1 week before the launch of the book. And what these guys did, Crossword, Landmark, etc., they displayed it at the cash counter.
Mm.
Okay. Now remember, this was before smartphone.
Correct.
Cash counter in those days was this magical place where only serious customers came because you're waiting to buy.
Right.
And you have 30 to 60 seconds when the guy is making the bill when you have nothing to do. And you see this chapter with a very nice cover out there, Sign Free on top.
So you just pick it up and...
Many people picked it up. Many liked the first chapter so much that within a day they started coming back to the stores, ki kitab kahan hai? So Crossword and Landmark got so much positive feedback just out of the sampler that they raised the order even before the launch of the book.
Amazing.
So that's why it became a bestseller in the first week itself. So it was just some innovative ideas. It just worked.
And how did you think of Shiva?
I'm obsessed with Lord Shiva.
Yes, so am
so
I.
So then naturally, you know, that our family is a Shaivite family. And with all respect to all other gods and goddesses.
No, other gods don't feel bad. They're equally confident. There's so many devotees of so many other gods.
One of my younger readers had said, Lord Shiva is the dude of the gods.
He is.
He's such a cool god. So I was always obsessed by him. And if you think about it, if I'm writing a story to convey a philosophy on what is evil, the best hero of the story is the destroyer of evil himself, Lord Shiva.
And yet you were an atheist during 92-93.
I was, yes. So, I grew up in a very religious family. My grandfather was a pandit in Varanasi. He used to teach at Banaras Hindu University. So, I was a believer when I was young. We grew up in a very traditional religious family. In my college days, my twin brother Ashish and I, we turned into atheists.
Because of riots.
It had happened at that time. And that troubled us in 92, 93.
So why did it make you not believe in God? When somebody becomes an atheist after being a believer, I think he is or she is angry with God.
You know, the correct thing would be not angry with God, but
disappointed.
Angry with religious people.
Religious people.
Now, or rather upset. And we were children, Ashish and I. We were like 15, 16. Anupam ji, if you remember at that time, Mumbai passed through a...
Yeah, I was there, of course.
Very difficult period.
I remember that, yes.
Now, I was in Xavier's College. I remember when the first bomb blast had happened, we could actually see the smoke from... And our entire gang, in fact, our group had people from all religions. Everyone said, ki, yaar, religion is what is causing these fights. My parents weren't happy about it. And in fact, my father spoke to Ashish and me, ki, you have to realize then people, when people are misunderstanding and misusing religion, that is the time for religious liberals to speak even more loudly so that you give the right message.
Right.
But we were children. We didn't understand. And we turned into atheists. For
how long?
Maybe 10, 12 years maybe.
Really?
Yeah. So long periods. Through my working life, when I started thinking of these philosophies, actually, I came back to faith. And if you think about it, maybe that journey was meant to be, because when I came back to faith, I actually understood much more deeply many of the philosophies that I'd learned as a child. My father used to tell us that, look, in the traditional dharmic way, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, Sikh, he said there's nothing wrong with being an atheist. Okay, that is allowed. Some of our philosophical schools are atheists. Sankhya, Mimamsas, Charvaks, they are atheists. They don't believe in a creator god. But they are Hindu. Right? He said, but the key thing is that in India, atheism doesn't mean a hatred for religion or a hatred for God. He said, because when you are infusing hatred in yourself, it actually harms you even more. He says, if you calmly make a decision to be an atheist, that's okay. But if it's a form of rebellion, that is childishness. And I understood it much deeper as I grew up. My father was right. Of course, he was right. But you go through that journey, you understand the answer much more deeply.
When I was looking for work in the city, there were some tough days. There were days I remember that I was sleeping on a platform and I was angry. I said to God, I said, what is this? I'm a gold medalist from the National School of Drama. You're making me sleep on a railway platform, making me go through an undignified life. I don't want to pray to you. But when I said, I don't want to pray to you, I didn't pray, but I was thinking more of him or her.
Yeah.
When we were very poor, my mother was told by a sadhu, don't think of something black on a Saturday and your problem will be over. My mother used to only see black things. So, but that's fascinating. And then you wrote one book, and second book, and third book, then trilogy. Your latest book is called Idols, and is devoted to idol worship and spirituality. Tell me a little more about that.
Anupam ji, there was a tide in history over the last 1500 to 2000 years where idol worshipping was derided and frankly even worse. It was attacked. Many idol worshippers were massacred, millions of them. Entire cultures were wiped out. Much of the ancient world was actually idol worshipping.
Yeah.
The Greco-Romans, Egyptians, Mesopotamians, Central Americans, Celts. And they didn't just die out quietly. Most of them were violently wiped out. They were killed.
By whom?
By invaders, largely two groups, European Christians and Turkic Muslims. Because they believe that idol worshipping is wrong. It's not that all Christians did it, because African Christians didn't do this. Indonesian Muslims didn't do it. It was essentially these two groups. And first they did it to themselves, actually, because European pagans also were killed off. But the reverse never happened. Idol worshipping cultures didn't go around the world saying, you're not worshipping idols, you're evil. They didn't say that. Now, I'm not saying idol rejecting cultures are all wrong. In fact, they have a lot of strengths. They don't have many of the internal divisions that idol worshipping pagan cultures have. Like, frankly, India has the caste system, which causes internal divisions. Idol rejecting cultures don't have. But idol worshipping cultures have a lot of intuitive strengths as well, which is intuitive liberalism. This book is actually to build the case for idol worshipping. Why am I such a proud idol worshipper? India is among the last surviving idol worshipping cultures, but even in a country like ours, a song like Patthar Ki Puja Karke Hari Main Hari, you're just worshipping a stone and you're losing. Such a song was written, such a song was produced, such a song was made into a hit by among the last surviving idol worshipping cultures. Because we ourselves do not understand what idol worshipping means. So this book is to actually explain the concept of idol worshipping, be aware of our areas of improvement, but celebrate our strengths, which is intuitive liberalism, intuitive environmentalism, intuitive respect for the feminine that comes with the idol worshipping way.
You're a very vocal person about India, about Bharat. You had a stint at Nehru Center in Great Britain, in London. What did you do to promote being an Indian over there? Sushma Swaraj ji asked you to be there.
I think it's a wonderful time and an opportunity to speak of Indian culture, because after many centuries of decline, India is rising once again. Anupam ji, your cultural influence and narrative power can only emerge when you actually have heart power. Otherwise, it's all theoretical. As India emerges more and more as a powerful economy, a little over 30 years ago, pre-1991, pre the economic liberalization, India's GDP was smaller than the gross sales turnover of a few car companies in the US. We were that poor. Just two or three car companies made more money than all of India every year. We were that poor. And within just 30 years, within our lifetimes, India is now the fifth largest economy on earth. Very soon, we'll be the third largest economy. It's been a fantastic boom. Because of that, there's much more interest in India if you go abroad. The Anglophone world, essentially, UK, US primarily, and through Canada, Australia, they have an outsized influence on global culture. A play in New York, can change how the entire world thinks about the American Revolution, Hamilton.
Yeah, Hamilton.
It's a power of New York. It's a cultural power of New York as a city. You can have a brilliant play in Mumbai, but frankly, it won't change the world because Mumbai doesn't have the cultural power that New York has.
We had Mahabharata and Ramayana here on television. People used to take off their chappals and garland the thing, but it didn't change the society.
But there was a time when India had that cultural power.
Yes.
Right? In the first millennium, more than 1,000 years ago.
Absolutely.
So much of Southeast Asia, they all actually, like today, people Americanize themselves. You'll have an Indian who'll walk by the US embassy and suddenly he'll get an American accent and don't call me Mukesh, call me Mike. Why? Because America has cultural power. There was a time when people used to Indianize themselves.
Absolutely.
Cambodians took on Indian names. UK, US are culturally very important. It's a part of historical processes as well because they've been so powerful for the last 200 years. So having a cultural impact out there has an outsized cultural impact on the rest of the world, which is where this London job was even more beautiful. And Nehru Center, we had an auditorium, art gallery, we were able to impact much of the cultural conversations out there. I used to go and make speeches at Oxford, Cambridge, BBC, various places, present the Indian point of view, because actually many of them don't understand India. So many countries which are misunderstood, India, Russia, so many places, because actually our point of view is simply not put up, you know, out there. And who's saying we are perfect? Of course, there are many areas of improvement, but our point of view should be put up, you know, out there. Otherwise, they have their own biases.
That's right. So why do they have biases towards India?
I think it's a layover of history, because they see us as people who used to be ruled by them.
Do you think it was because also our leaders did not sort of spoke about the greatness of our country, and now we have a leader who talks about the greatness?
Anupam ji, that makes a difference. I will not deny it. But the biggest difference is made by our own success. There's this economist called Ruchir Sharma,
Of course,
who had shown through his data that the lowest point in human history for India's economy relative to the rest of the world was actually not the British Raj. British Raj was, of course, disastrous. Our decline continued post-1947. Our lowest point in human history compared to the rest of the world was actually the late 1980s. In the first millennium, India was by far the richest country on earth, richest land on earth. We were 35% of the world's GDP. Our lowest point ever was the late 1980s. You know, in the 60s, we didn't have famine because the US was sending us charity. Remember that term, ship to mouth?
Yes.
They used to send wheat on ships. I thought millions would have died in India in famines. If you're in this situation, with what face do you talk of your narrative, your culture? Because they'll say, aap toh humare bheek pe jee rahe. How Acharya Chanakya said it so beautifully, sukhasya moolam dharmasya, dharmasya moolam artha. That essentially the heart of everything is earth. If you don't have wealth, you don't have power, you cannot build dharma, you cannot build happiness, you cannot build culture. Our biggest, I think, our biggest mistake was that we chose socialism as an economic policy post-1947. It didn't work for us. With the liberalization of 1991, our economy started booming. And therefore, it's no surprise now, as we are a wealthy, much wealthier country, we have a long way to go. We have started impacting the world culturally as well. Yoga is so big. Buddhism is so big. People are learning so much because they are interested, because India is powerful.
What are your views on this Ram Janmabhoomi, now Ram Ayodhya? It took us many years to fight. Finally, Supreme Court had to give the verdict.
It's a civilizational moment for us, Anupam ji. And, you know, what we are talking about, what happened to pagan idol-worshipping cultures, it has almost never happened that a pagan idol-worshipping culture has revived this way. Once the temples of Luxor were gone to the pharaonic Egyptians, it's gone. Right, forever. The news that had happened of Hagia Sophia, which was converted into a mosque recently in Istanbul. And even the Pope made a statement. It was built as a church, you know, and therefore now it's being converted into a mosque. Is that right? But what people have forgotten, that before Hagia Sophia was a church, 1600 years ago, actually it was a pagan temple to a Hellenic goddess out there. But there are no pagans out there in Turkey anymore, so there's no one there to remember that. This is a revival that has almost never been seen in the last 1,500 years. It's a civilizational moment. The second thing, I'm making a documentary also on this, Anupam ji. It'll come out hopefully with Lord Shiva's blessings.
What's it called?
Maybe it's called Ram Janmabhoomi, Return of a Splendid Son. Among the people we interviewed was this legendary archaeologist, K.K. Mohammed Saab. And I'm paraphrasing him. He said this in our documentary. He was telling me, he's saying, I'm an Indian Muslim. Babur was a foreigner. He wasn't from India. You know, he was from Central Asia. And so was Mir Baki. They're the ones who destroyed the Ram Janmabhoomi temple. K.K. Mohammed Saab said, what do I have to do with them? I'm an Indian Muslim. In that sense, I don't think the temple is a Hindu-Muslim issue. It's actually an Indian foreigner issue. There's a foreign invader who attacked us and destroyed that temple. And the temple is being rebuilt. And the way I see it, and I make this point in the documentary, it'll be wrong to say that, of course, it's a Hindu temple, it's a Hindu god, but we should be inclusive out there.
Inclusive. I think the gentleman who has filed the
Irfan
case,
Saab, he's coming out there. And this to me shows India.
Yeah.
You know, the one who filed the case from the Muslim litigant side.
Yes.
He is coming to the Ram Janmabhoomi temple.
Absolutely.
To celebrate Lord Ram.
Yes.
Because he was saying, because he saw the evidence being put up, you know, in the case. Because Lord Ram belongs to all of us. That's why to me, it's a civilizational moment. And if we use it well, this can be our takeoff point.
Do you think we will also send the message to the world about religious tolerance?
I think we will. You know, Chief Justice Bobre, we interviewed him at this documentary as well. And he himself mentioned the Hagia Sophia case. He said that the way this case was done, where it wasn't the majority or minority kind of getting into wars, it was actually proven in a court of law through evidence, right? So actually, there were archaeological evidence which was taken to prove that in fact, there was a Ram Janmabhoomi temple out there. So he says, so this is a much longer route, but actually it's much more stable because, and the example of Irfan Saab actually makes it clear. He says that if you do it this way, then there's no winner or loser because even the people who, you know, who the case may have gone against can see the evidence and they accept it, correct? They're not being forced to, they've seen the evidence, which is really why Irfan Saab, I guess, is, you know, is coming to the temple because he's seen the evidence.
Yes, I saw his interview and it was fascinating to see him being part of this whole celebration.
And I think because of the way it was done, because it was done through a process of debate, through a court process, through evidence presentation. It's not that anyone went and told him, you better agree to this, otherwise we'll kill you. It wasn't like that. It was a court case, correct? And he, as a litigant, would have seen all the evidence. So I think this is a much better way. It's longer, but it's a much more dharmic way.
Absolutely.
Because what is dharma? You carry everyone along and find the truth.
And what are you working on these days?
I have a book coming out on Emperor Rajendra Chola, who is a brilliant South Indian, an Indian emperor from the south, a Tamilian emperor who ruled much of South India, East India, and much of Southeast Asia as well. One of the greatest Indian emperors.
Yes.
So a story which will come out hopefully by the end of this year. And I have the fifth book of the Ramchandra series. This will connect it to the Shiva trilogy. So actually, both those series are actually linked to each other. One of the ways to see the Ramchandra series, it's a 1500-year prequel to the events of the Shiva trilogy.
Right.
And this fifth book of the Ramchandra series can be read as a minus one book of the Shiva trilogy. And the title itself makes it obvious. The title is Rise of Meluha.
Oh, that's amazing.
So it links it all together.
When are we going to see films made on this, all these books?
Whenever Lord Shiva wills it, one should work with you on that.
I would love to. I would love to be part of. And now you're anchoring also. I see one or two shows that you did as an anchor.
Yeah.
And how much time do you take to write one book?
It takes me a year and a half. It's been 13 years since my first book. I've released 11 books till now. So I'm a workaholic.
What are your thoughts on Bharat today, India in today's time? Where do you see India in 2047, when we complete 100 years of independence?
Counting for the last many centuries, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, this is probably one of the best times to ever be born as an Indian.
Wow.
You know, and we are going to be the lucky generation which will see this transformation. 1,000 years ago, India was by far the largest economy on earth. More than 50% of the world's culture used to get influenced by Central Asia, China, Japan, Southeast Asia, right up to the Middle East. We were the center of ancient trade. We were the center of ancient sciences, navigation. Our ancestors have left behind nearly 3.5 to 4 million Sanskrit handwritten manuscripts. That's more than the rest of the ancient world combined. We had the largest universities. We had, and all of it was, we slowly declined, you know, with the invasions that began from the 11th century onwards. Just 100 years ago, Prime Minister sitting in the UK could just pass orders, consciously ordering a man-made famine,
know,
which killed, what, nearly 4 million of our fellow Indians in 1942, just over, you know, 80 years ago. And we could do nothing about it, right? Just over 150 years ago, armies, foreign invading armies, could march right into the heart of our country, kill hundreds of thousands of people, take away women and children as slaves. This was the state we were in. Look where we are now. Can any army dare to come in? You know, in every way, in security, in economy, in culture, it's a great time to be born an Indian. The only thing I would say, this is one of, I'm an India lover, you know. I'm very optimistic about India, but yes, things which are worth criticizing, I will criticize. I think one of the biggest faults that we Indians have is that we get complacent very quickly. Today, one of the fears is, I think many are assuming ki it's written in our fate. We will automatically become powerful. Aisa, nothing is written. We won't get a better opportunity than this.
Absolutely.
But if we mess up the next decade, if we do our typical, you know, Indians, our biggest problem is internal disunity, starting to fight each other.
Hamesha, thousands of years, we are been defeated because of that.
Anupam ji, invaders didn't need to defeat us. We used to defeat ourselves.
Absolutely.
You know, because there was always, you know, internal disunity. We must remain united. We must remain focused. We must work hard. But this is one of the best times to be born in India. And if we get it right, yeah, we'll be back relative to the rest of the world to where we were. What an awesome time to be in India.
What is it that you want to achieve?
Making my own small contribution to a culture that I love so much. I'm not just a proud Indian because I was born here. I genuinely feel that in the modern world, India actually has a lot to add. We can genuinely make the world a better place. And I want to make my own small contribution to it. That's what makes me happiest to see. If I see any Indian telling me that they think I've added something, that makes me proud. That makes me really proud.
Thank you so much, Amish. And thank you for watching. Join me again next week for another intimate conversation and a unique view of India as we will talk about Bharat. I'm Anupam Kher. Namaskar.